Welcome to The Final Word, a Bible teaching ministry with pastor, teacher, and author Jim Andrews. The Final Word is grounded on the invincible conviction that what the Bible teaches, God teaches. And that is the last word. On this program, truth still matters. The Bible is in, Babel is out. The Final Word is funded by listeners like you. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about the program, please go to our website at thefinalwordradio.com. There you'll find archives so you can listen to any program you may have missed. Visit us on our social media platforms at The Final Word Radio and write us a note. We love hearing from our listeners. We'll provide other contact information at the end of the program, so have your pen ready. And now Jim Andrews continues his current study of God's Word.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us again on The Final Word. Before I launch today's exposition, I want to make our listening audience aware of not only the books that I have authored, but some articles that I have written that you might be interested in and tell you how to access them. In my broadcast, some of you have noticed that you hear very little about financial support, and that's deliberate. We really trust God here on that score and firmly believe that God pays for what He orders. Over the years, I have done a good deal of writing to prepare resources that I think should be helpful to my congregation and also helpful to you, our listeners. But on this program, I don't say a lot about those resources, much as I don't say a lot about finances, and I guess that omission in terms of resources kind of defeats the purpose. If you will go to jimandrewsbooks.com, that's one word, jimandrewsbooks.com, you will find there information describing the books I have authored. One of them co-authored with my daughter, The Finality of Jesus Christ. It's a very important book. And if anybody will let the Scriptures answer their questions about whether there are many ways to God, this will be decisive. Another very important book I've written is Polishing God's Monuments, Pillars of Hope for Punishing Times. I've written a book on marriage. Should help a lot of people if both are serious about walking with God in their marriage, Marriage Without Remorse, Rules for the Road. And finally, one about the pastoral ministry would be good for elders and leaders, too. Dispatches from the Front Lines, Reflections on the Glory and Grind of Pastoral Ministry. On top of that, on the same website, you'll see a tab that says Articles. If you will open that with your cursor, you will discover there are some articles that I've produced over the years that you may find interesting and helpful. For example, one of the most recent articles was my take on the demise of the culture wars and where I think we ought to go from here. Another article that appeared several years ago in a journal for biblical manhood and womanhood is entitled Boundaries Without Bonds. Another is a rebuttal of a tract that appeared several years back. The author attempted cleverly, but as I will show unsuccessfully, to persuade us that the Scriptures do not condemn homosexual practice after all. That has all been a misunderstanding. Well, there will be others, but I mentioned those three. I'm not a regular blogger, but when sometimes things pop up on my radar that I feel I would like to address in a thoughtful way, I will sometimes produce a longer article like some of these. We come to 1 Samuel chapter 19. In this text, we see where Saul is still doing everything possible to rid himself of David, whom he sees as his rival, though David is not his rival. But Saul, in his paranoid state, has invented David as an ambitious man who is seeking the throne. Now the text starts out, Saul told Jonathan his son and all of his servants to put David to death, an executive order for everybody to bend every muscle and take advantage of every opportunity to do David in. But Jonathan, Saul's son, greatly delighted in David, as we have seen earlier. He was a dear friend of heroic proportions. So Jonathan felt constrained to advise David that my father is seeking to put you to death. Now, please be on guard this morning and stay in a secret place and hide yourself. And what I'm going to try to do is prevail upon my father to interdict his intentions. So I'm going to go out and I'm going to stand beside my father in the field where you are. That is a place where David has been predirected by Jonathan. And I'm going to speak with my father about you. And this may have been a situation where David could overhear the conversation or perhaps not. We're not certain about that. And if I find out anything, learn anything that you're not able to overhear, well, I'm going to communicate that to you. This was big.
Well, then Jonathan spoke well of David to Saul, his father, and Jonathan said to Saul, his dad, "Do not let the king sin against his servant." I want you to notice that this is a moral rebuke. "He has not sinned against you. This man is innocent, Dad, and since his deeds have been very beneficial to you, leave him alone. Don't persecute him like this. Everything that he's done has been politically salutary to you. It's been beneficial to the nation." Verse 5, "He took his life in his hand and he struck down the Philistine, and the Lord brought about a great deliverance for all Israel. And you saw it, and you rejoiced. Why then do you sin against innocent blood?" Notice again, a high-toned moral rebuke by attempting to put David to death without any cause, without a just cause. Saul had a cause, but Jonathan means a just cause. So then Jonathan called David, and Jonathan told him all these words. And then Jonathan brought David to Saul, and there was a reconciliation, not needed on David's part, but there was one needed on Saul's. And then he was in his presence in the court as formerly. Well, there's war again. The narrative moves on. David went out and fought with the Philistines, and the text tells us that he defeated them with a tremendous slaughter, an overwhelming victory, so that the Philistines fled before the forces of David. And now, again, paranoia seizes Saul, an evil spirit, demonic spirit fills that vacuum with the permission of the Lord. There was an evil spirit from the Lord on Saul as he was sitting in his house with his spear in his hand. And this second time, as David was playing on the harp, second time mentioned earlier, Saul again tries to pin David to the wall with a spear. But again, David very athletically and very alertly slips out of Saul's presence as Saul is in a state of ecstatic madness. And David fled and he escaped that night. And now Saul is determined that he is going to have David's head. So we see that he next sends messengers to David's house. David's now married to Saul's daughter Michal, and Saul figures that he can manage this one. So he sent some of his agents to watch the house because he intended in the morning to capture him. Michal, his daughter, was alert to this scheme. How, we don't know. But she told David, "Look, they're watching, and my father aims to put you to death, and if you don't get out of here tonight, if we don't get you out of this house safely, tomorrow you're going to be put to death." So Michal does not take the part of her father, but she takes the part of her husband David, and they let him down through a window. We can only assume that they had a house near a wall or some such place, and he went out and he fled and he escaped. And then Michal took the household idol, what's called a teraphim, and she laid it on the bed. Now, this raises a question as to what some kind of idol like that was doing in her house, but I think it's a commentary upon the persistent problem of flirtation with idolatry that was always in the life of Israel, even after they came out of Egypt, and a commentary on the shallowness of the faith and the religion of this woman, Michal. Anyway, that's about all we have time to say about that particular thing. She laid it on the bed. It was apparently life-sized or nearly so. She put a quilt of goat's hair at his head to fake the impression of hair, and she covered it with clothes. So when Saul sent messengers in the morning to take David, she stalled him a little bit, buying as much time as she could, and she said, "He's sick." Well, they go back and tell Saul, and he sends messengers, "Sick or not, I want him, bring him on his bed. I don't care, but I'm going to deal with him now and put him to death." Well, when the messengers forcibly entered the house, on this occasion to take David out bodily, bed and all, they found not David, but this teraphim, this life-sized household idol, on the bed with the quilt of goat's hair at its head. And Saul was very upset at the disloyalty of Michal. And he said, "You're my daughter. Why have you deceived me like this and let my enemy go so that he's escaped?" And Michal said to Saul, this was not the truth. But in order to protect herself, she made up a story. And she said, "Well, he made me fear for my life. He said, 'You let me go. Why should I put you to death? I mean, it's me or it's you, so help me or you die.'" Well, no such thing had happened, but the story was so plausible to Saul that he was no longer angry with Michal, only angry that David had gotten away. Now, this brings us to talk about a subject that is very, very important. We all value loyalty in those who are closest to us. The closer people are to us, the closer we allow them to move in our lives, the more loyalty that we tend to expect of them, and frankly, the more they expect of us. The most disloyalty in history, the most disreputable, was the treachery of Judas Iscariot in betraying the Lord Jesus into the hands of his enemies. We husbands and wives expect loyalty from one another. Families expect loyalty from their kin, and friends tend to expect mutual loyalty from other friends. Governments expect loyalty from their citizens, and so on down the line, companies from employees and vice versa. Loyalty just happens to be one of those virtuous qualities that we admire in people. In the course of our lives, we're going to confront situations where, as in this passage, Jonathan and Michal, and we're going to see it even in Samuel, there is a conflict of loyalties. We get caught in the middle, between a father and a mother, between siblings, between friend and friend, between peers at school and parents at home, between our loyalty to our employer and our duty to the public interest, or between our government and Christian principles. Or maybe it's a conflict of loyalty between the interest of the many as opposed to the interest of a few. There may be somebody, for example, in our church family that we feel obliged to be very loyal to, but what they need and they want, which is not necessarily evil or wrong in itself, however, is contrary to the interest of the many. And that puts us kind of in a vice, and these things can be tearing tensions that are emotionally draining and also socially straining. But more important, misplaced and misguided loyalties, and here is the biggie, misplaced and misguided loyalties can lead us into great vice and lead us into serious offense against God and against our Lord Jesus Christ. Loyalty, I want to say, is a virtue that walks at all times on the edge of vice. Let me say that again. Loyalty is a virtue that at all times walks on the edge of vice. So it is important for you and I in the exercise of loyalty to be prudent and to be principled. A loyalty, I'm saying, must not be blind. It must, folks, be biblical. In short, I'm saying that as great a virtue as loyalty is, loyalty has to have boundaries. And we see some people in this narrative, first Jonathan, then Michal, and then Samuel. In verse 18, David fled and escaped and came to Samuel at Ramah and told him all that Saul had done to him. And he and Samuel went out and stayed at Naioth. Samuel took him in, gave him a place of refuge. This was treason as far as Saul was concerned. Samuel had loved Saul. Saul had now been deposed. Samuel had to stand for God instead of standing up for Saul, whom he had loved so much after he had anointed him. Tensions like these are classic conflicts of loyalty that we Christians have to confront all the time. So I want to talk about this issue using this passage and the loyalty decisions that we see here as a platform. Where the issue of Christian loyalty is concerned, there are really four postures. There is blind loyalty, which is based on self-interest. There is biblical loyalty, which is bounded by biblical principle. There are divided loyalties, a dainty, mincing, dicing, piecemeal loyalty that tries to spread itself around without offending either side of a polarity. And then there's what we might call a ghost loyalty, easily professed but never produced when self-interest gets in the way. Now, blind loyalty, and you see a lot of that, unfortunately, among church people. Blind loyalty is the kind that says, my friends or my group, right or wrong. It is unprincipled, and it draws no moral lines. Just the other day, my wife was talking to a dear friend that lives in Texas in the general Dallas area, and our friend was relating to us a sad story about a church there that she had attended for years, and she said their church was in turmoil. And without going into the details as to why they were in turmoil, she was in a class, our friend was, of people that were largely in her own age group of about 90. And these folk were all disenchanted. They were disaffected by what was going on in the church. And so what they were doing was kind of hiding out in their own class. Our friend was the only one that was still attending services, and they were refusing to give to support the ministry of the church. And their loyalty was not to Christ. Their loyalty was, our friend said, largely to one another. This is a blind loyalty that says my friends or my group right or wrong. It's a loyalty that we too often see among professing Christians that draws no moral lines. Now, biblical loyalty goes as far as it can go, but it ends where evil begins. And like Jonathan, like Samuel, and even Michal here, it has its boundaries. Divided loyalty is lukewarm. As I say, it's mincing, it's piecemeal loyalty that seeks more to protect itself and its social interest rather than looking out for the Lord's interest. It just parcels out little tidbits of loyalty in such small and discreet portions as to try not to define either side of a polarity. And then I said ghost loyalty is that kind that people lightly profess but seldom produce when the heat is on and self-interest is threatened. Now, the bottom line is that people who cannot be loyal cannot be trusted. On the other hand, get this, people whose loyalty is unprincipled and doesn't have moral boundaries cannot be trusted either. Principled loyalty of the kind that Jonathan had, of the kind that Samuel had, and exhibited in this passage, principled loyalty or faithfulness to others is a reflection of the very character of God, one of whose moral attributes is truth or faithfulness, Exodus 34:6. God is faithful to all of his promises, and he's faithful to all of his people. And all of God's promises include those that are implicit in those aspects which are consistent with his moral character. In other words, we can depend upon God not to vacillate in his character, not to flip-flop on his promises. God is what he is, and he is immutable in his character and all of his promises, and he is no respecter of persons. He is a respecter of moral principle. So we who follow Christ and imitate the moral excellencies of the Father are to be loyal to others in the same way that God is loyal to us. Now, how we resolve these tensions, folks, can go very far in deciding the very course of our lives. If we make wrong and unprincipled choices, and we cast our lot with wrong persons, the die may be cast. We may have to pay a heavy price at some level. In short, notice that loyalty is a virtue that lives dangerously, always walking, as it were, on the edge of serious vice. I repeat that. Loyal people must always be aware that they walk a fine moral line. Today, loyalty is not a cultural virtue. People expect it, of course, a lot more than they give it. Those who give it often do in a blind and unprincipled way, which is as bad or worse than being disloyal. And there are people who expect blind loyalty, and they're absolutely infuriated. I've been there. I've seen that. They're absolutely infuriated when their friends rise up in a principled fashion and refuse to go with them where no one should go. It is important in the Christian life to nurture loyalty, but in a boundaried way. Loyalty in a friend is a virtue of great price. People who cannot be loyal cannot be trusted, yet our loyalty to other human beings has to have biblical limits, or else loyalty degenerates into complicity in their sin. Well, let's talk about principled boundaries, and what are some of those boundaries? Well, first of all, remember this. Loyalty to Christ must always have right of way over any lesser loyalties in life. Read Matthew chapter 10, verses 32 and following. There is no relationship that the Lord is willing to play second fiddle to. Our loyalty to biblical principles takes precedence over loyalty to any people in your life or my life. Abraham had to put his loyalty to the Lord above his loyalty and love for Isaac, and Abraham the same way with Sarah. Our loyalty to people should end where conflict with the will of God begins. Our loyalty to others should end where sin begins. Our loyalty to people ends where the compromise of biblical principle begins. I knew a very devout lady. I still know her. And she is sweet as an apple pie and the kind of person who is very cherishing of relationships and very protective of those. But she was in an environment where some folk were just behaving pitifully. And these were friends of hers. And one of her friends had just been going on and on in a mouthy and a bitter way, in a godless way. And this dear lady was not the kind that would like to alienate any friends. But finally, her loyalty had its limits, and she looked at the other person and she said, "I just wish you would stop it. I don't want to hear any more of this. This is sin." Oh, would to God that more of that kind of thing would happen, that men and women would stand on principle, biblical principle, and not on blind personalities. Our loyalty, all things being morally equal, should always side with the good of the many as opposed to the good of the one or the few. Now, some things, all things are not equal, but all things being morally equal, we should always look out, be loyal to, if we're forced to make a decision there, to the good of the many, as opposed to the good or the one or the few. My loyalty should always be determined on the basis of truth and reason, rather than on the basis of emotion and relationships. Jonathan, I mean, after all, this was his father, for heaven's sakes. Father that he loved, a father that he had believed in, a father that had raised him and nurtured him. And there was a lot of emotion there, you can be sure, and we will see later that Jonathan still couldn't believe that his father was really intent on rubbing David out. He just couldn't bring himself to believe that Saul, maybe he experienced spells of madness and maybe he had attempted to kill David before, but Jonathan, I'm sure, had rationalized that and said, you know, these were just spells. But to believe that his dad had a hardened intent to rid himself of David, Jonathan had a tough time coming to terms with that. So loyalty should always be determined on the basis of truth and reason rather than emotion and relationships. And my loyalty should always come down on the sides of God's interest, folks, rather than on self-interest. So it was with Samuel. He always carefully aligned himself with the interest of God as he knew it and understood it. And my loyalty, all things being equal, should be to those in nearest relationship to me rather than those in remote relationship to me. And that was Michal. Her nearer relationship was to David now, not to her father Saul. But again, we have to add that condition, all things being equal. Another principle, loyalty cannot be divided, friends, like a piece of pie. It must choose between polarities. In Matthew chapter 6, Jesus said, "You cannot love God and mammon." That is mammon, an expression that refers to wealth. They are polarities. You cannot have it both ways. You cannot have your cake and eat it too. You have to make a choice, so don't try to mince and dice and balance those two on both shoulders. It won't work. You have to take a stand and declare for one or the other. And finally, let me remind us, our loyalty is most suspect and most likely to be wrong whenever it follows the course of least resistance. In other words, we have to make a choice to go one way or the other. Oftentimes, it's the easy choice. That is, the wrong choice. The only loyalty that has no limits or boundaries is our loyalty to God. Him we are to love with all of our heart, with all of our strength, with all of our minds. Nothing is ever to be allowed to wedge itself between us so as to divide our loyalty to Him. There is a spiritual pathology afoot in our churches today, for example, a cult of family loyalty. Contrary to what some Christians mistakenly believe, God never intended that your greatest devotion should be to your family. Absolutely not. Your greatest devotion is to be to Him. He never meant that your family should be first in your life. He ordained that you should love and care for your family, but that He should be first in all things. Whenever our loyalty to family or any member thereof is so intense that it shortchanges our loyalty to Christ and subverts our duties to Him, it is misplaced. Let's not forget these things. Let's be loyal. But let's be loyal within God's boundaries. You have a good day.
The Final Word is a listener-supported ministry. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about this program, please visit our website at thefinalwordradio.com. Our postal address is The Final Word, 4565 Carmen Drive, Lake Oswego, Oregon, 97035. Our email address is info@thefinalwordradio.com. Our phone number is 503-699-9840. If this program has ministered to you, tell a friend about it. We do solicit your prayers for God's hand upon this outreach.